So tonight's shiur primarily is going to be about the mitzvah of Yashan, the mitzvah Hashem, and it's the Ilu Nishmash Mar Yochayim ben Avram, and him and his wife have been an integral force to allow people to fulfill the mitzvah of Yashan here in America and around the world. Rabbi Tendler is going to explain more what they did, essentially. But the one thing I want to say is there's a very famous Rambam. The Rambam says that there are 613 mitzvahs. It's a lot of mitzvahs. Why are there so many mitzvahs? So the Rambam says that if a person keeps one mitzvah to the best of his ability, just the fulfillment of that mitzvah completely. Obviously, it doesn't mean a person should do any isurim, but if a person fulfills one mitzvah completely, that is a guarantee that he will have the maximum of olam haba. So different people, I'm sure people have heard of Reb Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg, right? Reb Chaim Pinchas Scheinberg wore hundreds of pairs of tzitzis. And this couple, you could say they took the mitzvah of Yashan and they tried to fulfill it to the best of their ability. And that is something that is a guarantee for Olam Haba, like the Rambam says. It's Hashem, whether you're going to keep Yashan, you're not going to keep Yashan, and so on and so forth, is irrelevant. But there's a sefer called Derech B'Kudecha, one of the Bnei Soscha wrote a sefer. So he says that there's three ways you fulfill a mitzvah. You fulfill a mitzvah with thought, with action, and speech. Some mitzvahs a person cannot fulfill with action. Right? Certain mitzvahs, if you're not a kohen, if you don't live in Eretz Yisrael, whatever it is. But you can fulfill it with thought and speech. So even though, let's say, you won't keep the mitzvah of Yashan, but coming to the shir and listening to what the mitzvah of Yashan is about, that's also in a certain way, a certain connection to the mitzvah that a person could have with the mitzvah of Yashan. So I heard that half of Shas was studied for your husband. It's Hashem, his neshama should have an aliyah. Right, this is like a little bit of a theme as well, in that respect. And Rabbi Tendler said that he's not only going to speak about Yashan, he's going to talk about other subjects that have to do with kashrus in Mitzvah Hashem. It's a big schus. I know Rabbi Tendler for quite a few years, right? I used to work for his great uncle, right? I used to work for his great uncle and somebody that has unbelievable clarity. And I'll tell you something: a person can know all of Shulchan Aruch, and he can know it perfectly. But when it comes to kashrus, you need to have practical experience. And it's very rare for somebody to have both. For somebody to be first a big Talmud Chacham, but also somebody that has experience on the ground. And Rabbi Tendler is such a person. I want to thank Rabbi Vigon and his wife for setting up the chairs and putting out the food and taking care of this entire evening. And for all the people that came and listened to Divrei Torah and Matzah Shabbos, Emet Hashem. Okay, thank you so much. Rabbi Tendler, the floor is yours.
Everyone, thank you, Rabbi Roizman. First, I want to thank Mrs. Eshkol for being the catalyst for this event, and the Kehilas, Ara Torah, and Shari Shalom, I think, Rabbi Nisano for arranging this, and to say it's a pleasure to be here takes on a new dynamic, especially when you look at the weather in Baltimore, where I come from, and it's about 10 degrees right now, with about a foot and a half of snow on the ground. And I had Rabbi Tesser, but, you know, he came even later than I did, and, you know, coming in here, and, like, we're still trying to figure out if, like, we really can go outside tonight, and then my kids jump into the pool, and, like, oh, what's going on? Isn't it the middle of January? Almost February already? So it's definitely an absolute pleasure to be here for many reasons, but for sure to be talking in Divrei Torah and discussing mitzvahs as important as Yashan and kashrus and things like that, you know, but the weather is certainly a bonus, as they say, the cherry on the cake. So, as Rabbi Rosen mentioned, we're going to discuss one and a half topics tonight, the main topic being the mitzvah of Yashan, which, as he alluded to, let me put it to you this way with a story, okay? When I learned halachas of Yashan and Reish Tzadik Gimel in Yeridea, this was about 15 years ago, maybe it was. So my Harus and I decided we're learning the sugyas on one condition, that we're not going to start keeping Ashen when we finish. Okay? That's the one condition we both made up and we agreed to, no matter what comes out, we're not going to start keeping Ashen. And that's how we left it. And we learned through the sugyas and we decided, Lamaisa, that you know, whatever, the different shitas, and Lamaisa, it seems that the minhag ha'olam, at least in the Ashkenazi world, is not to be makbir on Ashen, and that's it. And then, my uncle, Rav Yosef Tandler Zecharno Livracha, was nifter. Right after that, it was actually his Yotzei Tu B'Shvat, and my grandfather, Zecharno Livracha, Rav Moshe Tandler, his brother, came to Baltimore to sit Shiva. And I lived on Yeshiva land at the time, which is, anyone knows Baltimore, there's the regular Baltimore community land is where the Yeshiva is, which is about 4 miles away. So my uncle was the Manal in Yeshiva, so he lived on Yeshiva Lane. They were sitting Shiva on Yeshiva Lane. So my grandfather came, and he stayed by my house, which never would have happened otherwise because my parents live in Baltimore also. So anytime he'd come to Baltimore, he stayed by my parents' house, obviously. So I lucked out, and I had him stay by my house for Shabbos. And he was a Mila Shiva, and I probably should not have been talking to him about whatever it was I was learning at the time, but I was doing it anyway. And we started talking about the sugyas that we were learning in Yashin, and I mentioned to him, like, almost derech agav, like in passing, that it's a little bit schwer, it's a little bit hard to understand how people are so makel about it nowadays, but it seems that the minhag everyone is to be makel about it, so whatever. He looks at me, he's like, what are you talking about? He's like, the schwer, his father-in-law, Rav Moshe Feinstein, he says, was very makbir on Yashin. It happens to be, in Rav Moshe's days, it was less of an issue with wheat, for sure, which we'll talk about the reasons why in those days. He says, with barley and oats, he always stocked up on right after Pesach. And he says, what do you mean, is that minhag ha'olam? He says, mefurash pasuk in the Torah, it's a daraisa, he has to be makbir about it. That was the exact reaction that I had. I looked at him, I was like, just... So he said... And I was like just dead silent. I was like, what? And he said, yeah. I said, well, I hate to tell you, but the challenge, this was Shabbos day by the Suda, the beginning of the Suda, I said, is not Yashan. He's like, okay, it's not the first time I'll skip challenge. And he didn't eat my challenge that week. And then the rest was history. After that, I was like, okay. No, but even then, and this is important to know, we decided we're going to start trying to keep Yashan, believe that there, and let's see how it goes, how hard or how easy it is. And so, at least in Baltimore, so we started trying to pay attention to products. And I made a list for my wife to try to help her out when she went shopping to decipher, at that time was Rabbi Herman's guide. And that list would then became the Star Cake Quick Reference Guide, as many people know. Which was deciphering, give you the exact date that's on the thing without all the paragraphs for each product or anything like that. And we realized that it's really not so hard. And... You know, from there, I guess the rest is history, but we'll get to that, how that, my involvement evolved from there. But, just mentioning something Rabbi Roizman said, as far as whether you end up keeping Yashin or not, that at the end of the day, there's going to be, in certain locales, it's certainly a little bit harder. And I don't know what the situation here is in Arizona, exactly, but, you know, I don't want anyone to walk out of here being disenchanted with the mitzvah in general, because realizing the importance of it, but at the same time, it's hard to keep in Arizona. I don't know whether it is or isn't. Maybe you could ask, you know, there's enough people here who can answer the questions as far as locally, whether it's hard or not to keep Yashan. I was on the phone on my way here with Rabbi Isaacs and asking him as far as whether the peach shops here, if he could find out what flour they use, you know, but I don't know if anyone here knows the answer to that question or not. The whole wheat elabal is good? Oh, okay.
That's a racist thing, by the way.
Whole wheat, you keep Yashan. Whole wheat, you keep
Yashan.
Okay. I want to make a comment on whole wheat a little bit later, but, you know, and it's something irrelevant to relevant kashrus issues, but okay. Anyways, as far as just the Rabbi Hagdama, as far as how my involvement started and as far as keeping the mitzvah of Yashan came about. But let's go back to the basics, go through some of the halachs and practical solutions that are going on right now in the story of Yashin. First, the main part of Hakdama is that, as the Rav mentioned, tonight is dedicated in memory of Shmayu Chaim ben Avram, Mrs. Eshkol's husband, whom I've never met, but I think his contribution to the world of Kashrus, specifically in Yashin, is something that's remarkable. And there's a pasuk in Kehelas. Right, as Pasuk Kehelas says, "V'yosrei Masha Haya Kehelas Chacham Oid Tikin Oid." What's my pasuk is exactly? Oid Limei Dasas On VeIzin VeChiker VeTikin Mishalom Harve. That a bigger mila, a bigger advantage that Shlomo HaMelech had more than his great chachma and great wisdom was the fact that he made Torah accessible. He made Torah accessible to people, and that is his biggest praise, more than his wisdom. And I think, you know, if you look at what's going on now with Yashin.com specifically, the way it has literally transformed the ability for people to keep this mitzvah properly, is something that, you know, it can't be overstated enough. And it's a tremendous schus specifically to Mrs. Eshkol and L'chaim ben Chaim L'chaim, her husband's son of the bracha. And it's in a very unusual thing. It's an unusual thing for someone to take specifically one mitzvah and literally, as they say, knock it out of the park. Right? But, and I just asked her before I walked in, like, how she got involved. I'm not satisfied with the answer still, honestly. I'll tell you that much, because it really is on a different level. I don't know if you, maybe you don't appreciate it enough. I'm not sure you appreciate it enough, but literally the entire America for sure, you know, Europe and Canada coming soon. Australia got on board this year also. Literally is using this platform to enhance people's ability to keep this mitzvah. And it's not a small thing. It's really not a small thing. So that's something that should continue to be a schus for you, and I'm sure is a tremendous aliyah for your neshama. Now, believe it or not, this is my involvement has been going on, particularly since I'm involved with the Star K, the food service department, which is the restaurants and caterers. So Yashin is part and parcel of what I'm busy with all day long, because a lot of our places are actually certified Yashin, so we have to make sure they have the updated information. So Yashin.com is something that, you know, we've been working with for many, many years, but this is my first time, I think, meeting Mrs. Eshkol. She says my second time. I don't remember. As I say, maybe I'm getting a little old. Haha, pardon the pun. But, you know, anyways, it's definitely a privilege. Rabbi Heinemann says over a story when he was in Lakewood in his 20s. He was newly married at the time. And the city of Lakewood needed a new mikvah. This is in the 1950s. So Rav Aaron Cutler, Zichrono Livracha, asked Rabbi Heinemann to build a mikvah, which, if you know Rabbi Heinemann, makes a lot of sense. And he decided to go at that time to the Satmarov of Yael Teitelbaum, the original Satmarov, to ask him etzes in building a mikvah, because who else in America at that time really knew practical about building mikvah? Satmarov was very into mikvah, so he went to speak to him about it, and he told him one piece of advice. I mean, I'm sure he told him more than that, but this is what Rav Heinemann says over the story. He tells him in Yiddish, and I'll say in Yiddish first because it always sounds better in Yiddish, and then we'll translate it. He says, when you're building a mikvah, don't look in the Shulchan Aruch. He says, the second you start looking in the Shulchan Aruch, the mikvah is already possible. I mean, build it in a way that you avoid shilos, that you avoid problems. That's the ideal way to build a mikvah. And Rav Heinemann took that as a lesson for, in general, the way he structures a kashrus agency, the way giving hashkofas on things, the way you certify things. Do it in a way that you avoid problems to begin with. Instead of certifying the way, and then you might have a problem this way, you might have a problem that way, as much as possible, you want to do it in a way that you avoid all the problems and all the issues. And for sure in Yashin, for sure in many areas in kashrus, which we'll get to some of them a little bit later, that's something that he took as his mission statement in building policies, as we call them. And that is something that also people get confused about, because sometimes you have halacha, and you have what we call in the kashrus world, kashrus policies. And kashrus policies transcend halacha, and the reason for that is very simple. It's because, let's say in your own home kitchen, right, you have milchus, fleishiks, and parv all going on at the same time. Everybody does, right? God forbid to allow that in a certified restaurant. Why? Because in your own home kitchen, you have it, and you make mistakes. Let's admit, everyone can admit you make mistakes, because I know you all call the Star K hotline also when you make mistakes. I make mistakes, everybody's human. Add 10 non-Jews to the mix in the kitchen. What are the chances of a mistake happening? Exponentially higher. Enter a kashrus agency into this picture, and we have to try to figure out a way to avoid those problems from happening. So we make policies where we just say, listen, we don't want to deal with it. We don't want to have a situation that can create problems, and therefore we try to avoid it as much as possible. Now, that's a general hakdama to the kashrus aspect of it, but then we're going to blend it in with the ideas that we're talking about as Yashin. Now, when I first started at the Star K, so I learned very quickly that I was outmatched by my lack of knowledge. And what I mean by that is that I learned Basar B'Cholov and Taruvas, you know, in Kailal, and I come into the Star K, and I'm realizing that we don't use Basar B'Cholov Taruvas for much, almost at all. We don't use Bittul for anything, because we don't certify anything that involves Bittul. So, what are we left with? Mishnah for Shef a little bit, but otherwise Basar B'Cholov Taruvas is something that You literally, you can leave your Shulchan Aruch at home. We don't need it for anything. You know, we have policies in place that basically avoid almost every single thing in Basar B'Chol and Taruvas. The place where all the action is in Machol Yakum, which is in Bishul Akum, in Pas Yisrael, in Machol of Yisrael, in Hapshar Kalim, Tvilas Kalim. That's where all the action is, where things that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. And that's very much true. And I encourage, always encourage in the light, you know, if you want to get into kashrus, don't bother about the whole taruv. It's not that you don't need to learn it, but it's not the main thing. Main thing is the sugyas of machol yakum. Now, the funny thing is, especially those of you who are learning daf yomi, you know that all those sugyas come from a mishnah maseches avodah zarah. They're all derabbanan. Every single one of them is derabbanan. Yet, chol of Yisrael, and pas Yisrael, and bishul Yisrael, these are all things that are so much part and parcel of what every kashrut agency and consumers are busy with calling. Is Chol of Yisrael? It's not Chol of Yisrael. It's dairy equipment. Everyone's very busy with these things and these questions. And it's all the rabbanans. There's one area where, for some reason, doesn't get enough attention, at least in most communities, and that is Yashin. Because Yashin, as we mentioned before, is only a pasuk in the Torah. That's all. Just a pasuk in the Torah. Not a mishnah of Avodah Zarah. It's a pasuk in the Torah, says Mefurish, that you're not really allowed to eat grain that is chadash. Now, again, I'm not trying, I was not going to qualify the kulas involved, but let's just leave it at that for now. But the Torah says, Mefurish, Zalechem akoli v'karmelo socha etzayim azeh, you can't eat it until the first day of Pesach, chutz la'aretz, the second day of Pesach, you can't eat the new grain until that happens. Now, people get very confused by this. So let's clarify the reality of the mitzvahs over here. Now, Arizona is a good place to talk about it. And here's why. Because the way it works in America in general, and other countries is a little bit different. Australia actually was interesting dealing with them because they're backwards, because the Southern Hemisphere is very, very unique. But the way it works like this. The grains are planted 2 times a year. They're either planted in the beginning of the spring, around April approximately, and they're harvested in the summer, right? In the middle of the summer, that's when all crops are harvested. And then there's some grains that are planted in September, October, and they're then harvested, sit in the ground dormant the whole winter, and they're harvested in the summer as well. Now, the two types of crops are called a summer crop, or winter crop. Now, the reason why that's important is the following thing, is because, as I mentioned, the Pasuk says, you're not allowed to eat yosh, you're not allowed to eat chadash, the new grains, till the first day of Pesach. So what that means is that when the grains are harvested in the summer, which is when all grains are harvested in the summer around, what's the exact date? Around August time. Sometime in August, approximately, depends on the year, depends on the weather, but sometime in the middle of the summer, the grains are harvested. Theoretically speaking, those are not allowed to be eaten until after Pesach. So whatever was harvested this past August, a couple of months ago, is still sitting in warehouses, not allowed to be eaten until after Pesach. Now, theoretically speaking, you can eat a Chol HaMoed, but you're going to have a hard time making those on Chol HaMoed, so I wouldn't advise it or recommend it. So for all intents and purposes, it means after Pesach. Now, what I mentioned before about winter crop, the reason why that's important is because winter crops, since they were planted in the beginning, in the fall time, they sat dormant in the ground the whole winter, right? And they sat in the ground during Pesach as well, so they don't have a problem of chadash. They're not subject to the restrictions of chadash, and therefore anything that's known as, we call it winter wheat, is something that would not be a problem of chadash. And that's a very important factor to keep in mind. Because there are a lot of products that are made from winter wheat, in which case they are not subject to the restrictions of chadash. Why are they planted then?
Ishlish.
In order to something to avoid the restriction of chadash, it has to be planted before Pesach. It has to have taken root, which is after only 3 days of Pesach it needs. Approximately 3 days of Pesach. Some should say 2 weeks, but 6 months for sure is not a problem anymore at that point. It has to be in the ground. Yeah. Right. Now, the reason why that's important, and that's interesting to talk about in Arizona, is because in Arizona, there's no such thing as a spring crop. There's no spring wheat that grows in Arizona. It's too hot. And the funny thing is that if you go to Yuma, Arizona, which is where our lettuce comes from, sorry to jump topics, but our lettuce comes from Arizona, one of the most common things they rotate crops with. You can't plant the same crop again and again and again every year in the same place in the ground because it ruins the ground. You have to rotate the crops with other things in between. Wheat is one of the most common things they rotate lettuce crops with. And they grow a lot of wheat in Yuma, Arizona also. And this is where I know that in Arizona, any place with a desert climate, you cannot grow a spring crop. It's too hot. They can only grow winter crops. So any time, if you were to come across wheat that's from Arizona literally grown in Arizona, you can be assured it's going to be Yashan. Now, I don't know how much that exists. I have no idea. But that's just something to keep in mind. If you go to a local store and they're selling Arizonian wheat, or whatever they would call it, then you can guarantee that's going to be Yashan. Okay, but that's as far as that goes. Now, Yashan only applies to the Chamesh Shmini Dog, and only applies to the five types of grain: wheat, oat, barley, rye, and spelt. Does not apply to rice, does not apply to tapioca, does not apply to any other type of grain. That's something that is very important, and a lot of people get confused about that. And another thing is that, well, let's do it this way. Why are people makel on this? Right? Why are people makel on this? Why has it come about that it seems like the people who are makbid on Yashan are the exception? Even though it's definitely on the East Coast for sure, and bigger communities becoming more and more popular. But why are people makel on it? So there's three reasons. Number one is that there's the Shita of the Bach, the famous Shita of the Bach, that holds that wheat or grain that's grown by a non-Jew is not subject to the restrictions of Chavash. Now, everybody argues on the Bach. Everybody argues on the Bach. But L'maisa, the Bach says it, and that's what the Bach holds. There's also the Shita of the Taz. The Shita of the Taz holds that it does not apply in foot flies. And everybody argues on that also. But L'maisa, it is the Shita. Now, all the Paiskim also say is that you also have to appreciate the what? That doesn't apply in foot flies. Right? Now, you have to also appreciate one more thing. And that is that, you know, Klal Yisrael historically lived. Now, I find it funny saying this in a room full of Sardim. But let's say Ashkenazic Jewry, at least, lived and came from areas in Russia and Europe where there was one of two things that existed. Number one is they also had very few spring crops in those places, even till today. In very cold environments, they don't have spring crops, they only have winter crops. So therefore, Yashan was less of an issue. But I don't even know if they knew that or appreciated that. The second thing that they had, or they didn't have, was money. Right, people, they lived in abject poverty in the Shtetlach in Europe for thousands of years. In Europe, Klal Yisrael was not living in the way we live today in America with tremendous amount of wealth. And this was something that, you know, to give you a story from, you know, a story just to a little bit appreciate this, is that someone once came to Rav Moshe and asked him a shaila and hilchos treifos on a chicken. And he sent them to go ask somebody else. It's another Rav on the Lower East Side at the time. And he said, explained to me afterwards, the reason why I wanted you to ask him is because that person was a Rav in a Shtut in Europe. Ramesh was also, but different story. He sent it to him. He says, why? He says, a Rav in a Shtut in Europe had to be a tremendous expert in Hilchos Treifos. He said, why? Because if someone came to you with a chicken, you can't look at it and say, you know what? Better to be machmer. I saved up my entire week to buy this chicken for Shabbos. Now you tell me throw it in the garbage because it's treif. You had to be absolutely sure that this was not kosher. Anyways, that's the story. The bottom line is people had no money. They had no money. They had no food. Right? You would not be able to start throwing any extra chumras on them if there was any valid shitas that allowed them to have more food. Then that is what they were going to go with. And this was the minhag in Klal Yisrael, in general, in Europe. And I'm sorry if I exclude the Sfaradim by saying minhag in Klal Yisrael in Europe. I don't know what the minhag by Sfaradim was in their countries. I have no idea. I don't know if any of you know what the minhag was in the old Sfaradish countries. I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know whether they were or makbid. I don't know what the situation was there. But for sure, by the Ashkenazi countries, you know, food barely existed. Forget about trying to include any chumras of Yashans. Therefore, the Taz and the Bach became the absolute accepted minhagim in Klal Yisrael at that time. And for thousands of years, that's what they went with. And when people ask the question, it's like, why is everyone so into being makbid on Yashan nowadays? Why is everyone, you know, like your Zaydas, Elta Zaydas, the minhag in Klal Yisrael was not to be makbid on it? The answer is very simple. The reality was very different then. They had no food, and therefore they had to be makel on it. And therefore, it's something that really, really, really was a real reason to be makel. But nowadays, the situation is, Baruch Hashem, very, very different. With that, we can start appreciating the last reason that people are makel. And this one is the most important reason. And that is the one that the Rosh brings, the Ramah says, and that is the idea of a Svek Sveka. The idea of a Svek Sveka is the following thing. The Ramah says is that you don't know whether this is even from spring crop or winter crop, and even if it was, maybe it was planted before Pesach. Okay, now, you can appreciate the fact a little bit with, in this year, let's say even in America today, when exactly do they plant the crops? So, it's in April time. Pesach is around April time also. So if, theoretically speaking, if they would plant the crops before Pesach, this past year, Pesach was very, very late. It was in late April, the last week in April. So there was hope that the farmers in America would get the crops planted before Pesach, and there would be no Yashan season this year. There would be no need for Yashan season this year. As far as we know, it didn't happen. We don't really know exactly. It's very hard to pinpoint when the thousands and thousands of farmers out there planting their grains. So we don't really know. But at the end of the day, the Ramo is saying that there's such a thing called a Sfek Sfeika, which works even on Daraisas. And therefore, the Ramo was really the most compelling and strongest reason why people historically were always making on Yashan. Because the mice, you didn't really know what was going on. You didn't know where your grain was from. You didn't know where your bread was from. Spring crop, winter crop, last year, this year, no one really knew what was going on. On top of that, for sure, once everyone came to America, America used to have what they called the Strategic Grain Reserve, which is that the United States of America, during the Cold War, was worried about there being a nuclear war with Russia and nobody being alive and no one having any food. Those sound contradictory, but Mai said, don't ask questions about the United States government. Anyway, they had something called the Strategic Grain Reserve, where they kept years, about 4 or 5 years worth of grain in storage. And you're not going to keep it there endlessly, so what they would do was every year's new crop would go to the back end and they would use the older stuff. So they would always be using grain from 4 or 5 years ago. Everything on the shelf was from 4 or 5 years ago. And that was something that was always the way it was in America until I think it was 1991, 1992, somewhere around then when they stopped the Strategic Grain Reserve. So back to my grandfather's comment where Ramesha was Makel as far as people knew on Yashin. It wasn't that he was Makel. Nobody knew, even his own Talmidim didn't know that he actually stocked up on barley and oats. But as far as wheat goes, there was a very, very strong, compelling reason why nobody cared about Yashin in those days, because you had a very solid Sfek Sfeika. And a Sfek Sfeika is a very strong thing. It's a very, very strong thing. Now, it doesn't necessarily help for the Sfardim that go with their Mechaber who doesn't go with the Sfek Sfeika, but in an Ashkenazi world, I'm standing here defending us and saying that, yes, we had the Ramah to be Simechon, and it was a very, very strong, compelling reason to be Simechon. Sfek Sfeika, again, is a very, very strong thing that we use in many areas of Analacha, and it was something that was very real and very true. But then they stopped the Strategic Grain Reserve. And a man named Rav Yosef Herman Zichrono Livracha somehow found that out or realized it and recognized that that was a game changer in the world of kashrus of grains. And he went to speak to Rav Moshe and Rav Yaakov the way he says it and asked them that, one second, now that they stopped the Strategic Grain Reserve, that means that, technically speaking, it could be that every year when the farmers harvest their grains, it hits the market right away. In which case, now we're going to have a problem of chadash that didn't exist before in America. And the way he says over the story is that Rabbi Yaakov encouraged him to do research on this. Now, you can argue the other way too, is that maybe they should have told him to leave it alone, because as far as everyone knows, it's Sfek Sfeika, and as long as you keep it that way, everyone will be happy. Okay, but Torah doesn't necessarily work that way, and Shmiras HaMitzvos doesn't necessarily work that way, and if you come across something that is a very, very compelling reason that there's a significant change happening, so it behooves you to look into it, especially, again, if it's a daraisa. And that's where Rabbi Yaakov encouraged him to look into it. And what he realized was something that was, to him at the time, very frightening. And that is that, yeah, the grains were really coming on the market very, very soon and very quickly after harvest. And he started offering guidance to people who still wanted to be makbid on this mitzvah and give them information on where you can find grain, how you can tell whether grain was from this year or last year. And that's how the whole idea of Chadash in America really got on the radar screen. Now, there were Yechidim, particularly Rav Aaron Soloveitchik in Chicago, who were super makbid on Yashan even before Rabbi Herman's time. Now, they didn't really know what they were being makbid about because no one really knew how to figure this out, especially since they had the grain reserves. But he was very known, he would not eat anything unless he could confirm with absolute clarity that it was something from Yashan. From what I hear, this is even in the 60s and 70s and whatever, 80s, he would be stocking up on flour after Pesach and only using it after the next Pesach. And that's how makbid he was. And, you know, and he had his Talmidim are the same way. Like, it's very funny because when there's a chasna, let's say even a Baltimore or anything like that, and I know one of the sides from Chicago, I always warned the mashgichim. He says, just make sure you know. First of all, everything is Yashan by our caterers anyway, but he says, I'm promising you, you're going to get a million questions about Yashan. It's always like that because the Talmidim also are all super, super makbid on Yashan. And anyways, so back to Rabbi Herman. So Rabbi Herman developed this project, and for many, many years, that was the only source of information that existed for Yashan. And that's what everybody relied on. That's what the kosher agencies relied on. When I joined the Star K, everyone just went with the Rabbi Herman's guide. Our bakeries, even when I joined the Star K about 15 years ago, were all officially certified Yashan just because, you know, people were starting to demand it more and more. That was probably due a large part to the influx of Sfardish Rabbinei Torah, the generations of Sfardish Rabbinei Torah that started coming to America, learning in American yeshivas, and realizing that, you know, their heritage is very different than their Ashkenazi brethren, and they're supposed to be following the Shita of the Bet Yosef and the Mechaber on many things, which one of those things includes being Makbid on Yashan. And they started asking it. I remember as a Bachur in yeshiva, they always had two breads in the dining room. They had the bread for the entire yeshiva, and then they had for the Sardim, like in the corner, they had bread that they were able to get, Yashan bread for them. And that's how it was for many, many years. But because they started demanding their standard, it started becoming more popular. And then probably what happened was, Ashkenazim look at them, was like, you're so frum, one second, I gotta be frum too. I don't know what happened exactly, but they started becoming more and more popular. I guess it's a hard word to say, but it started becoming more and more popular in Ashkenazi circles as well. And this whole industry has kind of ballooned since then, where, you know, it's almost unheard of to have a commercial bakery, on the East Coast at least. I don't know about on the West Coast. I know in LA a lot of the bakeries are Yashan also. I don't know about here, what the story is here. They are or not? They are? They are Yashan? R&B, it's Yashan? Okay, good to know. I brought my own challah, I wasn't sure. But okay. But on the East Coast, it's almost unheard of to have a bakery at this point that's not certified Yashan. As far as stores, restaurants, and caterers, it's coming along. In Baltimore particularly, come on, every restaurant is certified Yashan again. And for one simple reason, just because the demand is there. The demand is there. And what happened with that was that Rabbi Herman started realizing, and then actually he started realizing it was getting a little bit beyond him, because the food industry is very, very complex. You know, there's besides the hundreds of mills in the country, each one, you know, bringing in chadash at different times, and the flours and the dates and everything, it was becoming very complicated. So what he did was he went with a very simplistic approach. He would call up the USDA, find out from the USDA when around the farmers started harvesting the grain, which is usually at the end of July. They would say, okay, it takes about a little time after they start harvesting until they get the grain to the market, until they bring it to the mills, etc. Somehow he came up with 2 weeks after the official harvest start date, right? That's going to be the Yashan cutoff date. And what he basically did was anything that was dated for after that time, he would consider chadash. So in his case, it was usually around the first week in August, let's say around August 7th, August 10th, whatever it was. He gave a date for years. It was like that. It was like around August 1st, sometime during the first week of August, he would give his cutoff date, and everything else just followed from there. The problem was is that once it was becoming more and more popular, and we were getting requests, the kosher agencies were getting requests to certify things as Yashan. So, you know, telling a bakery that the cutoff date is August 7th, you can do that. That means they have to stock up and make sure they have enough supply for the whole winter from August 7th and on. And that was becoming a challenge because, you know, storage is at a premium always, and for sure we need cool storage to avoid the flour from becoming infested. It was becoming a challenge. And on top of that, you know, we started realizing that, listen, we, the kosher world in general, are the ones that actually certify these companies, which means I know the people at the mill, I know the people in the company, and I could find out exactly when they're bringing in chadash. And what we started realizing, this was about 10 years ago, is that the dates were really much, much later. Rabbi Herman just couldn't have access to that information. He had no way of accessing that information. So he went with what he felt was a conservative estimate, a safe estimate, and he left it at that. But for us, that wasn't going to be enough, especially since the demand was going through the roof at that point. That wasn't going to be enough. We needed more accurate dates because it wasn't fair to the bakeries to leave them telling them it was August 7th when you go to the mill and you realize they're not bringing in chalash until September. That's a whole month. And then the distributors got on board with it and says, no problem, we got it, we'll handle it, we'll stock up for you, charge you a premium, of course. Now all of a sudden, bags of flour go from $12 a bag to $20 a bag, and guess who ends up paying the price? All of you. So we realized this was going to get out of hand very, very quickly. So we started doing the kosher agencies started doing our own research is a hard thing. It was very easy for us to get this information because we're there anyway. Started collating our information together amongst ourselves and let the consumers rely on Rabbi Herman. We gave Rabbi Herman the information that we had. Whether he used it or not, you know, honestly, he was a one-man show. And he also, you know, with someone who really gets the credit for putting Yashan on the map in America initially. All our work that we have on our website is dedicated to Nishmasai, including, you know, even Mrs. Eshkol's work is everything's dedicated to Nishmasai. He's the one that really put it on the map initially. But, you know, we didn't actually end up using his information in the last about 10 years simply because we had information that he had no access to that ended up being more accurate. And then Rabbi Herman was Nifter, I think pretty suddenly, and his children took over the project. Rabbi Moshe Herman, his son, and his granddaughter, Mrs. Raskam, were the ones that took over the project. And both of them really had other full-time jobs and capacities and other things. But they took it over as their father wanted them to take it over. And they took over the project and continued his work. But they were also stuck with the same limitations that he had, where he didn't have access to the companies. He was stuck calling the information line, you know, the 1-800 number, and finding out whatever information you can get from them, which is just, by the way, completely inaccurate. And I'll tell you a story about that in a few minutes. It's not a way to get information from anything, about anything, really, except if, you know, it's very, very difficult to rely on them for anything. But that's what they were stuck doing. About 3 years ago, his son, Ray Herman, called me up because he knew we were involved in Yashan, and he said, "I'm realizing that this is completely getting out of hand." He says, "We absolutely cannot keep up with getting this information together. It's an impossible task. We're not Kashrus agency. We're just independent people who are trying to enhance the observance of this mitzvah. We have no ability to keep up this information and keep updating it, you know, everything that needs." So we were able to get the date, and then also something else that happened that year, which was a good thing, is that Mrs. Raskam had a baby, like Rosh Hashanah time. And that meant that their project Chodesh was put on hold, you know, until she was able to get back to it. And they realized, like, this is impossible. They can't do this. If everyone's relying on them for information, this is not gonna work. So they asked if the Kashrus agencies would be willing to take over disseminating Yashan information, which is something that we were more than happy to do, because in all honesty, we had the information anyway. It's just a matter of then, you know, finding a platform to put it out to the public on. So we said, sure, we'll take it over and we'll figure out a platform to disseminate the information to the public. It's something we have. We all internally had the information already, and it was just a matter of, you know, they wanted us to promise that we would carry on their father's legacy of making the information available to as many people as possible. So at that time, we knew about the website yashan.com, which I think the way it started, and I guess you'll correct me if I'm wrong, I think Rabbi Herman had a psak from his rebbeim not to put his information on the internet. That was his thing, not to put information on the internet, which is fine. But I think, you know, he had been requested many times to put it on the internet, but he refused because of that, you know, that his hadrach from his rebbeim was such. But I think Mrs. Eshkol, I don't know if it was you or your husband, someone realized that it was you. Okay. That this was something that Lamaisa nowadays in this century is something that is where people are going for information. And if you want people to be able to keep Yashan properly, people being able to access the information, the days of going to pick up a hard copy of anything, for that matter, are over, and the information needs to be available online. And they asked Rabbi Herman if they can take his information and build a website around it, and he agreed, right? Easily? Gave you a hard time? Yeah, pretty easily agreed. What I remember being told by others is that he had no problem with others taking this information and putting it online, as long as he felt his rebbeim told him not to do it, but other people wanted to do it, no problem. So the website yashan.com existed already, and we reached out to Mrs. Eshkol about it at the time, and saying if we can work with them to kind of revamp all the information that was out there on yashan.com, and basically use the information coming directly from the Kashrus agencies, which is very, very much more accurate and not based on guesstimations and things like that. And, you know, she wholeheartedly agreed. And that's kind of where the partnership between Yashan.com and the Kashrus agencies came from. And that started already, 3 years ago or something like that? Approximately 3 years ago. Where the information, you know, is being fed to Yashan.com directly by the Kashrus agencies. But one thing halachically that has also done is that completely trashed the Svek Sveka aspect of it. Because now we know exactly We know any product that you have, basically, we know exactly whether it's Yashan or whether it's Chadash, you know, pretty much with certainty. So it's very, very hard nowadays to rely on the Ramah. So basically, anybody who these days is not going to be Makbid on Yashan is going to be relying either on the Taz or the Bach, which, you know, yes, were part of the Anhaga of Kal Yisrael, why Kal Yisrael was so Makel on Yashan, but Kal Yisrael also always had the Ramah on the Sech Seika. And now in America, at least, you don't really have that so much. So it's become a little bit harder to justify people not being Makbid on Yashan. At the same time, you know, there is the Tach and there is the Bach. And they are shitas that are valid. They're people that we rely on in many other years in Halacha, many different shitas. So in situations where, you know, it may present difficulty to Makbid on Yashan, you know, everyone can certainly ask their own shilas. You know, I'm not going to stand here and say that there's no heter for anybody not to be Makbid on Yashan. I think that would be the wrong thing to say. But I would tell you two things. That number one, keeping Yashan is much, much easier than you think. Again, I can't speak for in Phoenix, Arizona. On the East Coast, for sure, is something that's very, very easy to do. The information is out there. And luckily, it's only becoming a little bit more difficult to justify not being Makbid on Yashan. So those are the points that I would make. In, you know, encouraging people to try as much as possible to be makbid on this. You can try it, and especially now, if you want to start now, it's the end of the season now, you only got about 2 months till Pesach, actually exactly 2 months till Pesach. You know, Tu B'Shvat is Monday, that means Pesach's in 2 months. Tu B'Shvat means Pesach's in 2 months. In the world of Kashrus, that's what it means. Everything's Pesach. Right? Hanukkah is 4 months to Pesach, Tu B'Shvat is 2 months to Pesach. And nothing in between matters anymore. But you know, it's something that you can try. You can see what's available in the stores. There's a lot of national brands things that are out there that really are Yashan already, and or made from winter wheat. And there's all the information is available on Yashan.com, and you can take a look if you want some practical etzes. We can discuss about them afterwards because you know it's going to get kind of cumbersome to go through all the different examples. But it's really something that is not really so hard. On the same note, I would tell you the story that I referenced earlier as far as calling up the companies, and this is just one example. Bulgur grain, which I know Sfaradim use a lot. Bulgur grain, we have information from many different sources that all the bulgur grain that's sold, at least in America and Canada, is Yashan, it's made from winter wheat. Someone called me up a few weeks ago and said that he called up Bob's Red Mill, which is a big company, big grain company, and the rep told him on the phone that they use spring wheat for the bulgur grain. So he called me up and says, how can it be that you guys are telling everyone that bulgur is always Yashan when Bob's Red Mill is telling us that they're using spring wheat? So that was a very interesting question, and you know, I called the right Teichman from the Circle K who certifies Bob's Red Mill, and I said, like, you know, can you find out? So back and forth, we ended up speaking to the Mashkiach who goes into the plant, okay? And he said, I don't know what to tell you. The reps have no idea what they're talking about. He says, I'm in the plant. They do not have spring wheat in this plant. He says, they're making bulgur from winter wheat. This rep has absolutely no idea what they're talking about. So that was a very, you know, I've seen this before, but I'm saying you have to be very wary calling up reps from companies and finding out, you know, information because they really, a lot of times, they're not trained to answer questions that Jews are asking them. Okay, they're trained to ask them questions about consumer complaints and things like that. That's as far as the extent of their training goes. Now, at the same time, an answer that is given often when people ask questions to Yashan.com, particularly trying to figure out whether an item is Yashan, is we don't have necessarily information about every particular product, but what we'll do is we'll tell you the product has an expiration code on it. You can call up the company and ask them, how long after the product is made do you say it expires? So if it's 12 months, then you know that it was made 12 months before that expiration date, and you can basically try to figure out from there whether the product is Yashan or not. So here's an example. This past year, there was a lot of bad weather in many parts of the country, and that basically was a lot of rain. In fact, in Maryland and in most of the country, there was actually, I don't know about in Arizona, because Arizona is a very popular place to harvest wheat also, for matzahs particularly, there was no matzah wheat harvest on the East Coast this year. It was too much rain. They couldn't do it. You need at least 4 days of no rain in order to be able to harvest wheat for matzah, and we didn't have it. The entire summer, we did not have it. Yeah, it was. I mean, you never heard. We know what rain is, by the way, right? You know, rain is water comes down from the sky. You know? Because the matzah has to be dry.
Yeah.
So this year it has. How it just raises the prices? That's all. But it happens to be that a lot of the matzah companies, the matzah bakeries, have a few years worth of grain in stock. They always do that. They always did that. So it didn't really affect anything. I know Papa, for example, I was there last week. He has 4 years worth of supply. 4 years worth of flour supply from previous years. So he's fine. So there was stuff was always yesterday anyway, but that's besides the point. But anyway, but this past year was a lot of bad weather. So what that means is that even the farmers that need to harvest the crop, they can't harvest in the rain. Because then the stuff's going to turn moldy and turn bad. So they have to wait until it dried up a little bit. So the way we work nowadays is the following formula. And that is that we know from the mills exactly when grains are harvested. And it takes about anywhere 4 to 6 weeks to actually cut the wheat from the ground and send it to the mill. In the mill itself, it could take anywhere from days to weeks to months until they mill it into flour and then put it into silos. And then again, days, weeks, or sometimes months until they send it to the companies that are going to be using it. And there's a lag time in between, and it varies greatly. Each time can vary greatly. So the way we work is like this, is that we know from the mills when they're getting in the new crop. Every single year we know pretty much with certainty each mill. And that doesn't affect necessarily consumer products yet. This is talking about straight flour. So flour is the first thing that becomes chadash every year. And this year, it wasn't until September. It wasn't until September that the first mills started getting in the new crop. It was sometime in the middle of September when all the mills started getting it in. And then the only part of this that we estimate is that we give it about a month after the mills start getting in flour that it takes until it reaches bakeries and cookie companies and pretzel companies and things like that. The reason why we estimate that is because, first of all, we don't necessarily know information right away from every company when they're getting in chadash. And there's a difference because every year the crop is different. The protein content is different. The gluten content is different. Everything is different. Now, for home consumers, you just go to the store and buy your all-purpose flour, your blood flour. It doesn't make a difference to you. But for a commercial bakery, it makes a difference. Every single year, they adjust their recipes. Forget nothing with chadash and yashin. They have to adjust their recipes. Right? So they're very hesitant to introduce the New Year's flour, you know, until they absolutely have to. And what they typically start doing is they'll start introducing a little bit, and then a little bit more, and then a little bit more, until they make sure that their recipe is consistent with how they want it to be. So all that also takes time. So that's why, even if we know that the mills are starting to get in the chadash flour at the beginning of September, it takes time until the companies who actually are producing products will actually start using that flour. So this past year, what we did was we gave the default cutoff date for any product as October 1st, which means that if you're not sure whether a product is chadash or yashan, if it was produced before October 1st, you can be guaranteed that it's yashan. After October 1st, don't know. I don't know. And now, during that time, we're in touch with companies. We, the kashrut agencies, are in touch with companies and are actually finding out when they're going to start introducing chadash into their products. And that's how we build the list, you know, product by product, company by company, giving the exact dates for each product, what the expiration code is, what code to look for to know whether it's chadash or yashin at that time. But let's say this year was October 1st. So the only thing that a 1-800 number may be helpful for is you can call the company and you can find out how long they code their product for, and they'll tell you it's 12 months. So if the product is coded for October 1st, 2026, or earlier, you know that it was yashin for sure. That's the only thing that a 1-800 number of the company is good for. Otherwise, you'd have to be looking at the list. And, you know, I think for the most part, most products at this point in the season are going to be yashin. Now, what? Most products in this part of the season are going to be either, well, we have information on whether they're yashin or chadash at this point. Because the companies have all introduced it. Now, the thing that is there's a new part to this, and that is something that I don't think even Mrs. Eshkol knows yet, because I just found this out on Thursday afternoon. And that is, it has to do with malt. And malt has been a product that has been very hard to get real information on, for no good reason. But Ray Herman gave dates on malt that had a very wide range of dates. Beer, he always said, was any beer that was produced after December 15th, was you have to assume that it's chadash. And products that contain malt, it was very confusing to figure out. It was sometimes in March, sometimes somewhere in between. It was very hard to get a pinpoint exactly when products containing malt would become chadash or yashan. And what we found out recently, actually it was on Thursday afternoon, was there was a big research project done primarily by Rabbi Price at the OU on trying to get a handle on this. And what he found out was the following thing, is that first of all, you know, barley is very, very, like many commodities, particularly barley, is very subject to pricing of market conditions, which means that farmers who harvest it, like any product really, but just because the demand for barley is a little bit less than wheat, they like to wait until the price is high before they sell it. Why not? Make more money, right? So if the price is low, they're going to store it and hold on to it and not bother selling it. And the last year or so, the price in barley has been very, very low. So a lot of the farmers that harvest barley have been holding on to it and not introducing it to the market, and instead just selling their old crop, which they have to get rid of and have no choice. They can't only sell and they can store it. And they've been selling it, you know, they've been using a lot of the older crop. And on top of that, you have different types of products. You have malted barley, which is the barley itself that you soak in water, that you use to make beer, for example. That, theoretically speaking, comes onto the market, becomes available somewhat more quickly. And then you have other products like malt syrup and malt flavoring and things like that, which take more time to produce because, again, every time you have to process something, you know, it takes more time and more time and more time and more time. And what he discovered, basically, at the end of the day, was that it's almost not possible, other than beer, which is probably later than anybody thinks also, but leave beer out of the question for 1 second, but any other product containing barley or barley malt, right, there's almost no possibility of containing chadash until February. Right, so we actually, I didn't send you this information yet, we're actually pushing the date for malt, anything containing malted barley till February 1st, which is conservative at that, right, but for right now we're going to go with that pending further research, is February 1st. Now, beer also?
You have
straight barley? Straight barley could be available earlier. That is very hard to figure out because that doesn't go through any processing. There you're just subject to market conditions where we don't necessarily know, unless you speak to the actual barley mill themselves, we don't necessarily know. So that, we're going to stick to the September 15th date for now, even though between me and you and the wall, it's probably later than that. Beer also, we know from, at least from one of the breweries we serve, or from Sam Adams, they did not get this year their malt in until January. That we knew already. That's why we gave them a July expiration date, because it takes 6 months for the beer to be 6 months expiration code on the beer. But a lot of the other breweries, the Stam breweries, are also... It's guaranteed later than December 15th. That's for sure. How much later? We don't know yet. I'm still waiting for some of the other Vadim to get back to us, trying to make a poll of many of the breweries to find out. But it's certainly later than December 15th. That's for sure. But for any barley malted product, it's something, the date we're giving now is going to be February 1st. So I'm giving you some more homework tonight. You can go home and start updating the website again. Okay. Anyway, that's as far as, so that's where we're holding now. You know, with the relationship between Yashin.com, the Kashrut agencies, how it evolved, why people are Makel, why people shouldn't be Makel. But again, you know, I'm not here to tell everyone what they have to do. Everyone has to ask their own Shilas, but this, I think, gives you a little bit of a background in understanding what, what's going on here in this whole topic of Yashin. Yeah. Listen, the Beis Yosef is machbid anyway, right? You know, but you know, I don't know. Again, in the old countries by the Sfaradim, what they did, I'm not sure. I don't know. I don't know what this. I mean, the Kavachaim was an Ashkenazi paisik, right? We always like to joke and say, you know, he always went with the Ramah. And I think part of it was also, I'm going to completely guess right now and just say, I would imagine in the Sfaradic countries where they were poverty stricken, they probably weren't makel about these things. But I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what they did in the Sfaradic countries. But for sure nowadays, you know, the Beis Yosef is machbid about it. You know, Pashas, he doesn't go with the Taz, doesn't go with the Bach. He says outright, you got to be machbid. Mr. Brewer says to you machbid about it, right? I'm saying you're from Ashkenazim. Brewer says no one should be makel on it. But again, you know, I'm just being malamis chus, more than being malamis chus, explaining why it seems that everyone has this impression, which is not a wrong impression, why the minhag b'Ashkenazim wasn't general to makel on it, because again, you have the Taz and the Bach. They had no money. They had no choice. And that's what it is. But Lamaisa, nowadays, the situation is very, very different. And even in America, in the last 25 years, the situation has changed. And, you know, my Shreya Zichron Levracha asked me when I started being Makbid in Yashin, he's like, I don't understand. He says, Ramesh and Yaakov weren't Makbid in Yashin, and all the Gedolim weren't Makbid in Yashin. He said, first, Ramesh was Makbid in Yashin. But a lot of Gedolim were not Makbid in Yashin. That's true. That's correct. But the truth is, in 25 years ago, there was a much more compelling reason why you did not need to be Makbid in Yashin. Right? So, and that's something that has changed nowadays. So that's something that, you know, is for people to be aware of. And, you know, again, everyone has to ask their own personal shailas what they should or shouldn't be doing. But this, I think, hopefully gives a little bit of an understanding and a background. Now, yeah.
I'm borrowing, if you're a stuck state seeker,
what do you mean?
Maybe it's due to the labor, the economics of the problem.
Good question. Solid question.
The Ashen one is the exact same as the Sacred Grand, by the way, right across the street.
The what?
They're both 99 cents. The cost of the Ashen and Chazash Parley. The same cost. Like, it doesn't take.
Really? I'll stock up. And even on the East Coast, not like that. Interesting. Okay, that's a valid question. That's a good question, actually. It could be this year now where we have this information that they're holding on to. I literally just found this out on a Thursday. They're literally holding on to it for long periods of time. It's very possible there could be a stock take on it. That's a good point.
Even though the information is available, isn't it
necessary to go to Eshel Levruy? That's more than Eshel Levruy. It's right in front of you. That's what I'm saying. It's right in front of you. Instead of going to Yeshiva World, go to yashin.com, okay? And you'll find it all right there, okay? Anyway. Question then, is it really a sex fake?
What?
Then is it really a sex faker? Then he's looking at the shot. I'm not supposed to be a real sex faker. Okay, we're not going to get into kufiyot right now. Okay, you know, but anyway, again, I'm not here to throw out any validity to people who are mekel. I'm not saying that. And that's not what I'm trying to say. Maybe not. You know, maybe not. The question is, what's your threshold? How much more do you need more than a thousand a bach before you get into it? I don't know. Again, that's why it's a personal question. Everyone has to decide on their own what they're going to do. But it might sound funny to say this. It's certainly more important than Chol Yisrael. Right? It's certainly more important than Chol Yisrael or Pas Yisrael or things like that. And I know in the world it's looked at the other way. Because Chol Yisrael and Pas Yisrael and Mamash, for some reason, we listen to Chazal, we listen to the rabbis, right? It's very, very important things. But at the same time, this is something that the sugya itself is a deraisa. You know, the sugya itself is stemming from a deraisa, not a gzeirah Chazal. Even if you want to say in Chutz La'aretz, it's only derabanan, right? But still, the mitzvah of Yashin is something that is a deraisa, and the whole mitzvah of Chol Yisrael is completely derabanan. Again, I'm not trying to knock. I'm just saying on a gauge of something. You know, Rabbi Ganak is very, very proud. You know, he's a Wayu Tom. He's very proud of the fact that he's not Makban on Chol Yisrael and is Makban on Yashin. And you look at it like it's funny. It's not funny. It makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. And listen, be Makban on both. Right? I'm not saying one, not the other. I'm just saying, but like, you're trying to understand the Chomer on Yonim. This is something that, you know, the Yashin certainly should be up there. Now, you know, on top of that, I just want to mention a few points in Kashrus certification in general, and that is that, you know, part of the challenge that we have as Kashrus agencies, you know, particularly with the advent of Yashin, is that, you know, our policy, even the Stargate policy, like almost every agency that I'm aware of, outside of Eretz Yisrael, and Eretz Yisrael, you know, none of this applies. No such thing as anything certified in Eretz Yisrael by any hashkacha that's not Yashin, because there none of these kulas are applicable, and everything in Eretz Yisrael is Yashin. Everything certified in Eretz Yisrael is Yashin. Everything certified by an Israeli agency is Yashin. In America, no agency, as far as I'm aware, very few, actually, there are a few, but very few, have a policy to only certify Yashin. Now, Rabbi Heinemann Shlita, personally, has always been Makbid in Yashin forever. I mean, Rav Aaron was Makbid in Yashin in his days, and since then he's been Makbid in Yashin, personally. But the Stargate policy does not require Yashin, but if something is going to put, if a bakery wants to be able to offer people and claim it's Yashin, then we're going to enforce Yashin. That's the way we do it. So if we put on the letter certification it's Yashin, then that's something that we absolutely will enforce, you know, on top of regular kashrus. So once you're in that realm already, then we enter the world of general kosher supervision, where that means that we have to maintain top of every single product that goes in there and making sure that everything being used here is going to be Yashin and everything there is going to be properly certified kosher. Now, the problem then becomes is that you don't always necessarily know what's in your food. And this has been the challenge, that bakeries who want to use products you know, from anywhere, you have to always make sure that they are Yashan certified. And you don't necessarily know, just because something is not something is gluten-free doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be automatically Yashan, because many oat flours are gluten-free, and now they have Molino flour, which is a wheat flour that's gluten-free. And these things are now becoming more and more popular, especially with the allergen world becoming so big, that you know, you have wheat flour that could be gluten-free, and then other gluten-free flours, and these are things that are ending up in many different products. The only time of year that you can be safe is Pesach, and where people who are gluten-free, you know, and people who are looking for products that are, you know, going to be free of any grains, you buy something that's certified kosher for Pesach, non-gebrucht, you're guaranteed that there's no gluten or any grain items in that flour, in that product. But
how about
the what?
Flour.
Which flour?
Acorn.
What about it?
Einkorn?
Einkorn is wheat. Einkorn is a type of wheat. Einkorn is German. Einkorn means one grain. It's a one grain wheat flour. It's just a regular wheat flour. No, it's spring crop. It's spring crop. Yeah, it's absolutely a spring crop, einkorn. Yeah, for sure. But anyways, so just, you know, the problem is like this. The problem is, this is a story that happened about 6 months ago, is that a company applied to the Star Care certification. And the way it works is that any company that applies to certification, you send in an application which basically lists all the ingredients and the products that you're going to make. And we take a look at it, and we call a feasibility study to see if this is something that makes sense for us to certify. And because if you're making something that has lard in it or something trafe, it's, you're wasting our time. So this company sent an application. Everything, they were making actually parv cheese, or what they know today as, they call plant-based cheese. And it would look pretty simple, straightforward. So we scheduled an initial inspection. Company was in California. I went out there, went to the company, and I walk into the ingredient room with my list, and I started going through the ingredients. And nothing matched up. Nothing. It said citric acid, I see lactic acid, I see sugar, I see salt. It says nothing was matching up. I said to the guy, like, honestly, what is going on here? He says, well, listen, employees come, employees go. We don't want anyone to know what's in our product. So what we do is that anytime a product comes in, when it comes to the loading dock, we have one trusted employee that goes, takes off the label, puts a phantom label on it, and that's what comes in. And therefore, it says citric acid, really lactic acid. No one knows what's in our product. Like, so what am I supposed to do? I said, aha, there's a cheat sheet that tells you what this is that and this is that. I said, thank you. Can I please have that cheat sheet? Like, now that I'm here, like, you hope you're not completely wasting my time. So he gives me the cheat sheet, and we go through it. And okay, we worked through it. It took a little bit of extra time. Look through it. Let me ask you a question. Why don't you look at the ingredient label? Look at the ingredient label. You see what's in the product from the ingredient label. It must be that reading ingredient panels don't tell you much about what's in this product. How could that be? They're going to get in trouble for nothing, right? How could that be? Very simple. They call natural flavors. Colors. Natural flavoring, artificial flavoring, whatever it is. There could be hundreds of ingredients underneath that natural flavors or natural coloring. All of them add somehow, even in a small way, to the flavor profile, the color profile. And because of that, to be able to just blend them all in and put one label and say artificial flavors, artificial colors, and you have no idea what's in your product. I mean, Coca-Cola. Nobody knows the formula of Coca-Cola. Look at the ingredients. You could see the ingredients, right? Obviously, you can't tell anything from reading the ingredient panel from the label. And even as far as allergens go, allergens are a very, they could give you a clue, but there's two problems. One, on one hand, companies go overboard with allergies, and they write every allergy under the sun because they don't want to get sued if somehow there's some kind of cross-contamination with something. And I'll tell you a scary story that happened this past summer. I know the guy it happened to. It was a bachur in Baltimore. It was at a chasna in Lakewood, and had ice cream for dessert at a chasna, and went into anaphylactic shock. Ended up in the ICU for 3 days. He's allergic to dairy. Okay? They called the kosher agency the next day, and obviously they were very alarmed. They went to the kitchen. It was pyre of ice cream. It was pyre of ice cream. They called the company. It was pyre of ice cream. And they were trying to figure out. Turns out what happened was that one of the employees did not clean the line. They used the same line to process milk ice cream and pyre ice cream, and they did a clean out. But they didn't necessarily do a clean out to the extent that would avoid potential cross contamination for allergens. So halakhically, it was pyre. Right? But someone had anaphylactic shock. So, you know, allergens and halakha are two different, completely different criteria. On the other hand, you have silk soy milk, for example, which is 100% parv, and it's OUD, right? Because they don't kasher. So they don't kasher halachically, right? Halachically, it's milchix, or milchic equipment, whatever it is. Molecules are not, you know, are not bleus. I'm sorry, bleus are not a reality. Bleus are halachic metzias. I mean, halacha says there are bleus here, there are bleus here. Even if you dig in and you look and see, there's not a single molecule of dairy here. If you didn't kasher it, halachically it's still milchix, right? So the two are not necessarily, they're not talking the same language, right? So you can't necessarily use allergens. You can use it as a clue, it gives you an idea, but you can't use one to paskin on the other. That's for sure. And that's where the challenge of certifying things in Yashin or in general kashrut is something that presents itself to kashrut agencies as being a very significant challenge. And the only way to know what's going on is to go out to the factories and see what's happening. There's no way consumers can do this on your own. There's no way you can find a call and ask, you know, people questions. You have to really be there and seeing what's going on. I always say that the most erlich, upstanding and honest guy or someone who doesn't keep kosher has as much respect for kashrus as you and I have for halal. That's not a political statement, but think about it for a second. Is that you're working in a pizza store, for example, and a Muslim guy walks in. Let's make it more exciting. You're a 19-year-old kid, and you're on your job, you know, in summer in between school and college or something, and you're working in a pizza store, and a Muslim guy walks in and asks you, is everything here halal? Is there any alcohol in your food? And you're thinking to yourself, it's a pizza store. And you say, no. No, there's no alcohol in the food. And then you happen to walk into the kitchen and you see that they actually add red wine for the tomato sauce to make it taste better. Are you going to go over to him? Don't eat it. Probably not. Right? Even if you say you would, is it reasonable to expect them to do that for you? Right? No. Right? I think everyone will agree to that. It's not reasonable to expect that. So why would you then do that to yourself and just call up and ask a question, or go up to the front desk of the hotel and ask a question, or go to the counter in the ice cream store and ask, oh, what do you put in your products, and actually believe that? If you would call the Star K and ask us, oh, how are you giving Ashkocha to this company? And they say, and we would say, oh, we just call them up and ask them, what do you put in? And they tell us, and we send them a letter of certification, just like that. You would run the other way, and rightfully so. Right? So why would you do that yourself? Right, so the challenge of certifying products is there because that means that we have to actually go out there and see what is really happening in all these products. And, you know, as you mentioned before, the dynamic of certifying things as Yashan basically means that nowadays, you know, we have to pay extra attention to all these things to make sure that we're doing an accurate job. And two changes I just want to mention, because these are things that are mamish, brand new in the world of kashrus that consumers would also have absolutely no idea. Two things that actually came into effect January 1st, 2026. And that is, number one, the tortilla law of California. Believe it or not, they have tortilla laws in California. Not just laws about exhaust fumes in parking garages. Tortilla law in California requires that tortillas sold in the state of California, this is what they're busy with, tortillas sold in the state of California must contain X amount of folic acid in them, which is a brand new law. Right? Which basically means that any company that's making tortillas now has to add folic acid. Now, what's folic acid? Vitamin B12. Right, what is vitamin B12? It can be made from one of two sources, either synthetic or animal. It's a protein-based vitamin. Right, so it's something that in the kashrus world absolutely must have hashgacha on it. But it's something that companies never had before. They never had to deal with this before, but now all of a sudden they're changing. So if you're a consumer out there and you decided, you look at your tortilla label and you figured out it's kosher, it doesn't have a hashgacha, but now you didn't realize that they started adding folic acid to it because they want to be able to sell it in the state of California, and now all of a sudden you're eating something that's not kosher. That's something you wouldn't know about. It's our job to stay on top of it, and Baruch Hashem, we are. Another thing that happened was that this maybe more people are aware, but you don't necessarily realize the repercussions of it, is that RFK now flipped the food pyramid upside down, which means whole grains are now on the bottom and fats are now on the top. So in order for you, a company, to start selling, to sell foods to the school systems, which every company wants to because of a huge volume, that means you have to now increase the amount of protein and fat content in your products. So you already had companies applying that we certify already, that now they need to reformulate their product. And one of them asked, is there any kosher tallow on the market? Because they want to start adding tallow, which is an animal-based oil, because it has more protein in it. They want to start using it now because they have to be able to fit in the food pyramid now to be able to fit the food, the school systems. Right? So this is also something that, again, if you're trying to read labels and try to do this Lone Ranger on your own as a consumer, you will have absolutely no idea. But it's something that kosher agencies, you know, hopefully, and have to be on top of to do the job properly to make sure the food that you eat is something, things that are 100% absolutely kosher. So that's something that, again, is me'in off the topic of Yashon, but the idea is that part of agencies being involved in Yashon and getting the accurate information in Yashon is also the way we do regular kashers as well, which means being out there, doing the job properly, being in, whether it's restaurants, being in companies, to make sure that we're staying on top of changes literally all the time. Is it as scary as it sounds that changes are mamash happening constantly? Yes and no. Yes and no. I have a list. I'm not going to go through it right now. I made a list because I gave this presentation somewhere else. You know, just in the last 2 weeks alone, how many different issues our mashgichim have come across, you know, and solved and avoided just because they were out there doing their job. And it's literally from catching non-kosher things potentially coming in, non-kosher food items, you know, just a few of them, just not going to go through the whole list, Dijon mustard. Dijon mustard is, as you know, mustard that has wine in it, and there's some companies that make kosher versions and non-kosher versions. The only difference between the two is one has a hechsher on it and one does not have a hechsher on it, even though it's the same label. Why? Good question. We should not allow that to be the same label. Okay, not for now. But the idea is that there are some companies on that have the same Dijon mustard, one with a hechsher, one without. And he caught, literally last week, caught the wrong Dijon mustard coming in. It has non-kosher wine in it. Absolutely non-kosher. That's just one of the things, you know, dairy crackers are supposed to be part of cranberry juice that contain non-kosher grape juice in it. Non-kosher dishes that were, if you go, by the way, in Arizona, a lot of hotels around here, go into any hotel kitchen. I almost guarantee you walk into any hotel kitchen around here and look at the sheet pans in the kitchen, okay, and you will see they are painted, some of them, red, blue, green, yellow, whatever it is that were left there, by a kosher caterer that was there, whether a Pesach program or otherwise, whatever it was. Right? You think it doesn't work both ways? If we forget our pans there, you don't think some of their pans get mixed up with ours? If not for the fact that ours, hopefully, are painted. Right? But that's something that, again, people have, mashgichim have to be on top of because paint wears off. Right? And this is something that is very, very scary. You know, it's pretty close. Butter instead of margarine, dairy ice cream, dairy cakes, gravy, turkey gravy in a can, Restaurant Depot brand. One with a hechsher, one not. One treif, one not. These are things that, you know, happen on a day-to-day basis in the world of kashrus. Again, Baruch Hashem, we're out there doing the job and making sure that things stay kosher, but it's something that takes a lot of effort, a lot of focus, and staying and making sure that we're doing it right. I just want to end off with a comment that Varda heard once, Shem the Belzer Rebbe. He says when Elisha... well, was leaving from Eliyahu HaNavi. So he made a very interesting request from him. He said, I want Pishnayim Baruchacha. I want to be able to get twice your abilities, your kaychas, your energy. And Eliyahu HaNavi answered him, and he says, in Tiras Lugach Midcha, Yilucha Kain. If you see me being taken from you, you'll get it. Which, you know, everyone has different ways of understanding what that means. He says it gave him a sign that if you end up being able to see me leaving this world, then that will be the sign. But the Belzer Rebbe uptight it a little bit more. He said like this. He said, what Eliyahu HaNavi was telling him is that if you see and appreciate who I am right now, and then you realize and appreciate the void that my absence is causing, if you realize that absence, you're on the level to realize who I was when I was alive and realize that it's no longer here. If you're zaycha to that, then you'll be able to step in. And of course, Baruch will give a siyata to the Shemaya to get Pishnayim Baruchacha. Says that's what Eliyahu HaNavi was telling him. He says, and I think, you know, looking at someone like Mr. Eshkol, who literally was Maisa Nefesh for a mitzvah like this, and realizing, which we do realize, because that website has been going through many challenges, you know, since he was Nifter. But, you know, seeing that someone like that was Maisa Nefesh, and realizing that now that he's no longer here, it's something that is a void that needs to be filled. And, you know, Mrs. Eshkol is definitely stepping in with all the other people involved in Yashon.com to fill the void. You know, but it's something that, you know, people step in and even on their own sense, you know, to start being extra makbid on this mitzvah of Yashon and the kashrus in general is something that will be a tremendous chus for his neshama, a tremendous chus for all of you. And with that, everyone should have much hatzlacha and a good luck. And thank you, everybody, for coming. Yeah.